seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have five cases on our calendar today, the first two of which are oral. Our first oral case today is Kathleen Ox versus Commissioner of Public Safety. Counsel will, for each party, will have 15 minutes for your oral argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We would greatly appreciate it if you can identify yourself and the party you represent when you start your oral argument. And the podium is adjustable, so feel free to adjust it if need be. You can, counsel for appellant can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Ryan Grove, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Ms. Ox. The brief facts are: on April 19th, Officer Corey Christensen was on duty, randomly ran a license plate that belonged to Ms. Ox, and stopped that vehicle for one purpose. The registered owner was revoked. He had an initial encounter face-to-face with that driver, who is Ms. Ox, the appellant. That lasted 25 seconds, and that's of great significance in this case and for this court in the determination of the totality of circumstances. I will touch on that later. After that initial encounter, Officer Christensen returned to his squad, where he began issuing a citation for one traffic offense, driving after revocation. That's it. While in his squad, he's looking down on his laptop, not up, and he's entering a citation. It takes him 3 minutes to do so. At that 3 minute period, his colleague Officer Booth arrives.
Counsel, you just asserted that the officer was looking down at his laptop. Certainly he was looking down at his laptop for a portion of the time, but is there any evidence in the record that he was looking down at his laptop for the whole 3 minutes or so that he was in the squad car?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there was testimony that he was looking down the entire time. But what is important is the squad video and body camera. You can hear and see typing. And you hear typing, printing of what would appear to be one citation for presumably would be an error. It was crumpled up. Then there's back to typing again on the laptop, and a citation was printed, folded, and that was the citation for driving after revocation.
I don't understand what you're saying in response to Judge Cochran's question. Are you saying that the officer did not or did look up, despite the typing, into your client's vehicle during that portion of the traffic stop?
I don't know if he looked up or not.
What was his testimony?
His testimony was that he was able to view the appellant in her vehicle.
And not was able to, but did.
Did.
And is there any evidence in the record to render that part of his testimony necessarily not credible?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I don't think it matters, because what I think
I thought it did, because you were saying that he was looking down, not up. That's how you began your argument. That's how we got into this discussion.
Well, certainly. And he was looking down for a period of time. My argument does not need to form the opinion that he did never look up. Squad video, Exhibit 1, gives us, the court, a view, crystal clear, of what he would have seen if he did look up. And that's through the lens of the squad video. When you're looking at the left side, driver's side mirror, you can see the appellant sitting in her car smoking a cigarette for 3 minutes calmly, where the appellant is putting the cigarette to her mouth, presumably inhaling, and then out of her window.
When you say calmly, there was some head movement.
Certainly. And there may be head movement while you're smoking a cigarette, but that doesn't rise to the level of erratic behavior. And
can I ask you a question, just if I can cut right to the chase? Aside from the description of the officer about this erratic behavior, help me to understand. Push back on this if you think I'm wrong about the facts, but as I understand it, from the officer's perspective, before he asked your client to perform the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, He knew that your client had previously been arrested for drunk driving. She had, he stopped her about 9:30 at night, after 9:30. It was a Friday night. She had glassy eyes. She avoided eye contact. She appeared, the district court described it as angry or agitated. She had a child in her car. And from the officer's perspective, she appeared to be exhibiting behavior that night similar to the behavior that the officer had observed earlier the night, the early morning, she was arrested for drunk driving. Have I accurately described the facts from the officer's perspective?
No, Your Honor.
In what way have I erred in any of those eight issues or factors?
It's twofold. First, the most important part is the initial encounter. After that initial encounter, the testimony is no erratic behavior whatsoever, no slurred speech.
That's not what I'm asking you. I mentioned eight different factors that the officer may have observed. I thought you said I was in error in some way with those factors. Are any of those factors in error?
The glassy eyes, no. If his testimony was that she had glassy eyes, there's no reason to dispute that.
What about any of the other seven factors I mentioned?
I don't think that goes to the totality of circumstances, Your Honor, because the prior...
My question was I right? Just as a matter of fact, does the record support the eight different factors that I mentioned as having occurred?
Can the court tell me the other eight? I know the one was the glassy eyes.
He knew that she was previously arrested for drunk driving.
That is correct.
He stopped her on a Friday night.
Correct.
The time was after 9:30.
Correct.
She avoided eye contact with the officer.
I would disagree and ask the court to look at the body camera.
I'm talking about what the officer's testimony was.
That was his testimony, correct.
She appeared to be angry or agitated.
No, that is not correct, and his testimony contradicts that.
I mean, the district court found that she was angry.
When crediting the testimony, correct.
Right, okay. So, and there was a child in the car.
Correct.
And from the officer's perspective, her behavior was similar to the behavior that she engaged in the night that, early morning, that he knew that she had been stopped for drunk driving.
That is his testimony.
Okay. All right, so... Would you agree that if those factors are all present and the district court didn't clearly err in finding those factors, are you saying that that would not be sufficient to ask about whether she was drinking or to ask her to perform a horizontal gaze nystagmus test, or that there needs to be something more?
There needs to be something more because it's a totality of circumstances. And when he left that initial encounter, it's very important that he stated no erratic behavior at all. So whether he says she was angrily avoiding eye contact, he didn't think it was erratic. That's what the court used in a basis to expand. No odor of alcohol, no slurred speech.
Let's talk about that for a minute. If you look at the court's findings of fact on A2, paragraph 6, I think the court finds that the second sentence, while filling this out, meaning the citation, Officer Christensen observed petitioner flailing and demonstrating erratic behavior. So the court didn't find that Officer Christensen testified that he observed, or that Officer Christensen observed erratic behavior when he initially went up to the car. It was while he was in the squad car filling out the citation that the court finds that he observed the erratic behavior, and that's consistent with his testimony on page 16 of the transcript and I believe in other places of the transcript. So I think your argument that the court found that he observed erratic behavior when he first went to the car is not quite accurate.
And let me be clear, my argument is not that the court found erratic behavior in the beginning. I understand paragraph 6 of page 2 in the addendum. What is important is to look at that squad video. This court does not need to take a blind eye or blanketly accept the findings of facts. Second, it's compounded. In State v. Sallow, it's a prior encounter in that case and this case, which led the officer to believe she's showing the same behaviors, therefore I believe she's impaired. That's not the case in this situation. She's not flailing, number one, but number two,
officer testified to other facts that led him to believe she might be impaired, such as her glassy eyes. He testified that that can be indicia of impairment.
He did testify to that, Your Honor, but that goes back to the totality of circumstances. Back to your previous question, Your Honor, as to the flailing and erratic behavior that he purportedly observed while filling out the citation. That was the basis that the district court found that he was allowed to expand. When you look at the McDonald situation,
expand on that for me. You said that it was the observation of her flailing and demonstrating that provided a basis for him to expand the stop. Where in the order do you see that?
Well, the conclusions of law are extremely minimal.
But the court says given the totality of the circumstances, so the court isn't relying just on that one finding of fact.
Well, when you look at number 6 on the addendum 2 and findings, and number 8, he's saying that it mirrored. And if I could touch on the mirroring, that's back to the State v. Salo. The prior encounter at McDonald's, the appellant was observed first swerving, second outside of her vehicle, stumbling, screaming, slurring, flailing around, and in Officer Christensen's testimony and words, all over the place. Let's compare that to what he testified he observed in this situation. She's inside of her vehicle. She's not screaming or flailing. She's calmly smoking a cigarette, and when he approached her, he was face-to-face with her, as close as he could have lawfully been at the time, and he didn't smell any alcohol. He didn't see any indicia of impairment, and he didn't...
Well, I don't think he testified to that. He testified that he saw glassy eyes. He saw her avoiding him. Where in his testimony does he say that he didn't see any indicia of impairment?
In that situation, in the first encounter, it's in the fact that when he left, he went back to his squad and he entered a citation. He entered it for driving after revocation because he had no other suspicions of impairment or any suspicions of any other criminal activity.
Did he say he had no other suspicions, or is that just what you're inferring?
It's what I'm inferring based on the fact that he went back to his squad.
So you're saying if an officer doesn't immediately administer field sobriety tests or inquire, that the officer necessarily doesn't have some suspicion developing about impairment?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor.
So that seems like that's what you're asking us to conclude.
He needs, after that, to have a second objective reason to believe that she's impaired. What he's using is...
Why?
That's what the law states, Your Honor.
Why does he need a second basis?
He needs an independent observation to believe she's impaired.
From the totality of the circumstances, he doesn't have to have a... What do you mean he has to have a second independent reason?
When he first went to the squad and he left, he testified he saw no erratic behavior. He saw no slurred speech, no odor of alcohol, no driving conduct. No one reported anything.
But he also testified that he saw glassy eyes, that she was avoiding him, that she appeared to be angry. The video shows her kind of laughing at him. And it's Friday night after 9:30. He knows she has a prior DWI. If you remove the question about the erratic behavior, why aren't those facts sufficient to provide a reasonable, articulable suspicion of driving under the influence?
They don't mirror the same behavior as the incident before.
But that isn't what I'm asking. Why don't those facts alone, if you take out the one fact about the erratic behavior, why don't the other 7 facts that Judge Ross was asking you about, why don't those by themselves support a reasonable, articulable suspicion in this case?
Having a child in your car is not an objective basis to believe someone's impaired. Having a prior DWI is not an objective basis.
Pause for a second. Having a child in the car might give the officer more incentive to inquire about, if there's other indicia, to inquire about the driver's ability to leave the scene safely. You're saying it doesn't factor at all in the officer's reasonable consideration of what to do?
It may, if there are other factors present. There were not in this situation. That's his testimony, Your Honors. He testified clearly.
Under the totality of the circumstances, you've addressed two of them, but address the totality of the circumstances, not the facts individually. Under the totality of those seven circumstances, why is that not a reasonable articulable suspicion? Why would an officer not have a reasonable articulable suspicion at that point?
Your Honor, I think I've addressed that there was no driving conduct, neither reported nor observed, no odor of alcohol, no slurred speech.
You're saying the things that weren't there. The question is, why doesn't the indicia that's there sufficiently justify an officer, not to make an arrest, just simply to administer the horizontal gaze nystagmus test while your client was still sitting in the car?
If that were the case, Your Honor, an officer could come up to a vehicle, see what he believes is glassy eyes, ignore all of the other factors that are not present, as I've argued many times here this morning, and then start a DWI investigation. That would be contrary to the precedent, contrary.
You say start a DWI investigation. You recognize that, I assume, that once the officer administered the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, there is reasonable suspicion for full field sobriety testing at that point.
I see I'm out of time, Your Honor, if I could quickly answer that question.
You may.
I would argue no. It was a modified horizontal gaze nystagmus test, but nonetheless, once he inquired about alcohol and administered that test, that is where the expansion occurred.
No, I understand that's what you're saying. I'm just trying to get a sense of whether you appreciate the slight intrusion at that point. I mean, the Fourth Amendment is a balancing test of what's reasonable, and the greater the suspicion, the greater the intrusion. So if you had a small amount of suspicion, enough to ask, have you been drinking, it doesn't seem as if that's as significant a constitutional concern as if he had pulled her right out of the car and asked her to perform field sobriety tests. Would you agree with that or not agree with that assessment?
I can agree with that assessment, Your Honor, but I think when you look at everything and the fact that he went back, it requires reversal and rescission. Thank you. And I'd ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Oh, thank you. You may.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Murn with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety for the respondent. May it please the court, counsel. At the outset, I want to address a couple of the questions that were raised as far as looking down the whole time. The part of the transcript that one of the parts of the transcript that deals with that is page 8. Part of the question on line 11, did you see the erratic behavior while she was in the car? Yeah. At a couple different points, it looked like she was kind of flailing around, being a little jumpier per se than a person I normally would stop. She wasn't very calm. It's clear that the officer was looking. One of the issues that goes along with that is if you look at the squad video, you can't necessarily see anything through the back glass. We're only looking at a fraction of what's really happening in that car through the left rearview mirror. It's like looking through a keyhole into a house. You're not going to see everything.
I think I looked at the squad car video, and it's hard to see what's going on in the car. Is the officer's testimony consistent with the squad car video, given that the video doesn't really show much activity by the woman other than what you can see in the side mirror?
From my review, I would say that it is consistent, but it also doesn't contradict. If you look at the State versus Berry case, or the Berry case that I cited in my memorandum, if it's not inconsistent, this court doesn't need to substitute the fact-finding decision of the court, the lower court.
It does appear that the officer may have exaggerated a bit, doesn't it? Jumping around, flailing. I mean, there was some movement, as I understand it, but not the flailing and the testimony seemed to suggest, if one were just to look at the officer's testimony, it would appear that the conduct was more erratic than the video would suggest was actually occurring. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I would agree that we can't see much through that left rearview mirror. I don't know what the officer could see from where he was sitting through the back glass or through the car itself. I will say that from what we did see, she was throwing cigarette butts out the window. Her arm went out to Ash several times, and she also seemed to bob forward and move a little bit while she was in there, move in and out of the field of view. So we have to take the officer at his word. We also have a situation where the trial court would be in the best position to review the credibility. And one of the things I noticed as I was reviewing the memorandum from the transcript again is that page 33 of the transcript, Judge McManus, we had asked to, or the respondent asked to orally argue. He said, "I am going to have to look at the squad video to see whether the testimony of the officer, if he saw any erratic behavior, if he had a viewpoint from that. So I can't make a decision now, obviously." And then you've got the court's order where he says, based upon all files, records, and proceedings, and he specifically lists Exhibit 1 as the squad video, as well as the testimony of Officer Christensen. So he would have been in the best position to see if that was consistent, and he still went on to find that the Officer Christian was credible, and he went through the glassy eyes, which appellant's attorney acknowledges he can't dispute, as well as the avoiding eye contact. There's some dispute with that, but that's what the testimony was, as well as the officer.
How would you, what would you say triggers this court's assessment of the record, particularly when you have a video depiction of events and testimony about what happened in the video? To what extent can this court consider what is observable in the video as a matter of law as opposed to a matter of fact-finding?
Your Honor, I think you have some of the cases that were cited by appellant's counsel where if it directly contradicts, then this court could show that it's clearly erroneous. But in this case, it's similar to Berry, where they found that the officer's testimony was credible. And to the extent the video conflicted the officer's testimony, the video was inconclusive at most. You can't see enough to see that it doesn't contradict. Your Honor went through the 8 different potential facts that lead to the totality of circumstances. We're looking at a totality of circumstances here. The only issue that appellant is challenging is the erratic behavior. We still have the other 8, and I would also...
By the way, I did throw in that having a child in the car is not, I think, a factor that's usually considered in and of itself. What's the state's position as to whether having a child in the car bears on the officer's reasonableness in expanding the scope?
Your Honor, I did not have the child as one of... I had a list of 8 as well that were consistent with yours, except I had one additional one. I don't think in and of itself a child in the car is indicative of impairment, obviously, but if you have a child in the car and he sees the glassy eyes and he's had a prior incident, he knows that she's under revocation, he knows she had a DWI arrest in the last couple months, she's mad, avoiding eye contact, I think as a totality of circumstance that would come into play. The 8th issue that I had was when I reviewed the video numerous times at 9:43:18 on the squad video, it appears that there's someone yelling, and the petitioner, there wasn't testimony about yelling, but Exhibit 1 is in evidence, so that would be another objective basis that would go along with the general
yelling
demeanor.
By her, can we tell that it's by her?
It seems to be screaming, and the
don't
other
you,
people are driving
don't you
by.
Other, I listened to that as well, and it sounded to me like the child was making noise and she was maybe responding to the child and possibly yelling. But it's hard to know, what is the significance of her yelling, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I guess the significance of the yelling, Your Honor, is that we've got a situation here where there's testimony that her behavior mimicked, and the trial court made a factual determination that it mirrored the prior behavior at McDonald's that ended in a DWI arrest. This isn't a case like the Salo case that the appellant relies on where the only issue is a prior, what they know about from a prior involvement with the person who was the driver or in the vehicle. Here we have a situation where you have the glassy eyes, you have this objective evidence on Exhibit 1 that there is some yelling. If you're being pulled over by an officer and you're yelling, I don't think individually, but we're looking at the totality of circumstances.
Isn't it more accurate, wouldn't the district court have been more accurate to say that at most her conduct at the scene here resembled the conduct at McDonald's as opposed to mirrored the conduct, given what appears to be a much more extensive description of behavior tied to impairment at McDonald's than at the scene here?
I think that the language that was used in the transcript by the officer of mimicked might be a better way to describe that rather than mirrored. It's not exactly the same. But as the testimony indicated, she was still in her car, so it's not as if she was outside doing the exact same thing as she was doing at McDonald's. But it did at least mimic that. Appellant's entire argument here is based on challenging the credibility and the factual determination about the flailing or the erratic behavior. When the district court's factual determination here is correct, we would not even have to address the appellant's underlying legal challenge if all of those eight factors, including the erratic behavior, is upheld to be a proper finding.
Assume there was no erratic behavior.
Even if there was no erratic behavior, we still have the other seven that would be on my list, which would include that screaming in addition to the six that you had indicated. And then we also have the erratic behavior. Even without that, we would have enough under the totality of circumstances. And one thing I would like to flag based on some of our earlier questions from the court, the divide and conquer approach of separating out different indicia, here the erratic behavior, the flailing of the arms, the United States Supreme Court in Arvizu said the court's evaluation and rejection of seven of the listed factors in isolation from each other does not take into account the totality of circumstances, as our case have understood that phrase. And here we have a situation where we can't just say that the flailing wasn't, maybe it wasn't as much as we can see on the video, but the district court found that that was the testimony, but we also have all the other indicia. We have to look at it as a whole. You have somebody who's driving after revocation. This officer has had experience with this person in a DWI arrest situation. You've got the glassy eyes, you've got the avoidance of eye contact, and you have...
How is driving after revocation, how does that factor into the analysis?
It factors into the analysis that she had had a prior DWI. She's not supposed to be driving at that time. And you've got a Friday night, it's 9:40 at night. There are cases, the State versus Lee case that I cite in my memorandum. If you're driving late at night on the weekends, it's more common to have impaired drivers.
Right, but is it more common? Why are you suggesting that? I'm joining Judge Cochran's question. The relationship between driving under revocation and impairment is what?
I think that the prior experience with this person who is now driving after revocation, after a DWI arrest, gives this officer the prior interaction with this person.
Well, you already counted the fact that the officer knew she was previously charged with drunk driving. So what does the revocation add?
The driving after revocation in and of itself does not indicate that someone's impaired. They could be driving around.
Yeah, well, not in and of itself, but you say it factors in the totality of the circumstances. How does it add at all, whether it by itself or together, to suggest impairment?
That this person has had prior DWIs and recently as well as in the past, that they've been revoked. It may be more likely. I don't think that there's case law to necessarily support a driving after revocation. So.
The appellant cites State v. Fort to argue that the facts aren't sufficient here to support an expansion of the stop. And I didn't see you, I don't think you addressed that in your brief. Can you briefly address that case now? That's the case where the officer began questioning Fort and noticed that Fort was nervous and avoided eye contact.
I think if you deal with the cases that deal specifically with nervousness, we don't have a situation like we have here where we have specifically glassy eyes, which is an objective indicator. You've got testimony from Officer Christensen that glassy eyes is an indicator of impairment. We also have that they were trying to avoid eye contact, which also can be indicative of drug use or alcohol use. But specifically here, we've got the glassy eyes. In the cases that you're indicating, along with the Ford case, it's usually just nervousness alone. We have these additional observations. And then I still will not concede that the erratic behavior didn't happen. We've got an officer who testifies that there's erratic behavior, and we have a squad video with a very limited view, which still shows her moving around.
It seemed to be qualified a bit. The officer, I think, suggested that she was sort of flailing and that she was a little jumpier than others. Not that she was jumping around, but that she was jumpier than other individuals with whom he had, with whom he engaged in traffic stops.
Yes, which would, he said the erratic behavior can be associated with impaired driving, but we also have a specific situation here where he has specific experience with this driver, and he's saying that it mimics the prior behavior where he knows that there was field sobriety tests and ultimately a DWI arrest. That takes it out of some of the examples where he maybe know in the other case where someone is on some sort of drug watch list or had been a known drug house. That's separate from an individual here where he understood that this was somebody who he dealt with before. I see my time is up. I would ask that this court affirm the lower court's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Grove, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. A lot of the questions have dealt with innocent explanations or why are some signs of impairment but not other signs of impairment enough to equal an objective basis to now inquire about a DWI investigation. I think this court should look at Westman versus Commissioner of Public Safety because the respondent heavily relies on that case. And in that case, there was a report of bad driving conduct. That was not the situation here. There was an initial interaction, which I've argued to this court is very important in this case. In that—
Can I interrupt you just for 1 second? So you're saying because in the initial interaction, all he saw was the glassy eyes and avoiding eye contact, and that was not enough for him then to inquire about drinking. Now, setting aside the later testimony, just the act that he went back to the squad car, I mean, wouldn't that be normal officer behavior in a traffic stop to run her name? He now knows who the driver is, get other information, and she was on a revoked license, so she's not going to drive away. So he knew, right, that there were going to be some further interactions with her, whatever they are. So just the fact that he walked back to his squad, I mean, is that what you're resting your argument on? Is the fact that he went back to his squad without... So he was satisfied at... are you saying that when he walked back to his squad car, he had no basis to expand the investigation to include a possible DWI, and that's kind of the end of it.
That is correct in part.
So by his act of walking back to the squad?
Not just the act of walking back. Okay. It's the act of walking back, his testimony about his interactions and the lack thereof of indicia of impairment, plus...
I don't think he ever testified that there was a lack of indicia of impairment at that point. Where in the transcript do you see that?
He does not say those words, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's the totality of circumstances.
But you just, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you just said the lack of, or I'm sorry, I thought you said the testimony of the lack of indicia of impairment.
I don't believe I said his testimony, and if I did...
I'm sorry, I'm probably wrong, so...
But if I could answer
your... But you kept arguing that, so I just want to be clear. He did not testify to that.
Correct. He did not testify to that, but he did testify to signs. Now, Your Honor, if I could answer your question further. Of course he's going to go back and talk with her after he issues a citation for driving after revocation, but it's what he tells his colleague that he has... memory of her where she's exhibiting the same behaviors, which I've already argued, they're not mirrored, which is important in State v. Sallow. And when he goes back up, his only purpose was to inquire about a DWI investigation. Have you been drinking? I'm going to run you through DWI tests. That is an unlawful expansion of the scope of the stop, and the duration should have ceased.
Well, expansion of the scope, I mean, there's two issues. One is the nature of the expansion, the other is the duration, and those are two separate issues. Let me ask you a question going all the way back. Do you think this officer had more or less reasonable suspicion concerning your client than Officer McFadden had when he stopped Terry?
If you could give me some more facts on that, I'd be happy to answer. Well,
Terry versus Ohio.
I understand.
Officer McFadden sees a guy walking back and forth in front of a department store and has some concern that maybe there's criminal conduct afoot. Maybe they're casing the joint. I don't know. But the Supreme Court said that was enough to stop and detain an individual. We're not talking about the detention of your client. We're talking about just expanding the scope of someone who's already been detained. So it's a slight incremental increase as to the intrusion into your client's constitutional right to liberty. So my question is, do you think that the officer in this case had more or less reason to suspect that your client may be impaired to conduct an investigation, that more or less reasonable suspicion than Officer McFadden had when he just watched Terry and his partner walking in front of a department store?
Less, Your Honor. He went up, had an initial encounter, and saw nothing besides glassy eyes. That alone, when you look at the totality and the cases cited by respondent, is not enough. And I see I'm out of time. I'd ask the court to take that consideration and reverse and rescind the revocation. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments here today. The arguments were very helpful. We will look closely at the case and issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.